Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible, or if you're like, I don't know where Ecclesiastes is, don't be ashamed. Most of us probably haven't read it. Page 470 in the little Bibles in the seats. So 470, Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And I got to be honest, I'm kind of surprised that you guys came back after last week. We started studying this book of Ecclesiastes, and it's kind of pessimistic in the beginning. It's a little depressing, but you guys, you're here, you're New Yorkers. Like, you love the punishment, I guess. So, but last week, we began studying this book, and just a little recap for those of you who weren't here. Ecclesiastes is written by a man who calls himself the teacher or the preacher, and scholarship seems to point out that the author of this book is King Solomon, the son of David. And what Solomon is doing as he's writing this book is Solomon basically conducts an experiment. He sets out to test everything that is under the sun, meaning test everything that is under the sun apart from God. I mean, he's going to test everything that the world has to offer. And his goal is to find out if anything in the world can satisfy the deep longings of our soul, and to see if anything has any real meaning. So he's going out, he's a philosopher, and he's in search of the meaning of life. What gives us meaning? What gives us lasting satisfaction? And last week, Solomon went kind of philosophical on us, and he tested wisdom, and he sort of did the philosophy thing, and he went philosophical on us, and what his thesis was that our life is a vapor. He says, our life is a vapor. We all live these short, inconsequential lives on this tiny little planet that's nothing but a pale blue dot in the expanse of the universe. He says, each one of us are inconsequential in the scope of the universe. He says, even if you accomplish great things in this life, it really doesn't change much. The earth will still revolve around the sun. The sun goes up, the sun goes down. Life just continues going, really, regardless of what you accomplish here on this earth. He says, your life is vapor, it's meaningless. And he says, most of you aren't honestly going to leave a real lasting legacy in this life other than a few friends and family that love you. And he says, even then, when those friends and family die, so it dies off the memory of you on this planet. And, you know, honestly, we're like, that's chapter one. And so from the beginning, we're like, I don't want to hang out with this guy anymore because he's kind of depressing. He's telling me my life is meaningless. And you're like, that's not what my kindergarten teacher told me. They told me that I could be anything and my life was so meaningful. And so right from the beginning, we're like, okay, Solomon, you're a little bit depressing and nobody really wants to hang out with you. But he gets a little bit more fun in chapter two. He's still going to be a little bit depressing this week. Next week, we're going to kind of get into some fun, more hopeful things. But this week, he's not testing wisdom. He's not going philosophy professor on us. He's testing pleasure. So we're essentially going to read through Solomon's college years today. And what he's going to do is he's going to systematically, one by one, pursue after every single earthly pleasure that any of us have ever desired to seek after on this earth. He's going to seek after these things with all of his gusto, with all of his might, and then he's going to come back and he's going to tell us what he found, what meaning he found in all of his pleasure seeking. And what we know about Solomon from at this point is we know that he's one of the wealthiest men. He's the wealthiest man alive at the moment, at this moment in time. 1 Kings chapter 10 tells us that all the kings of the world were jealous of him, and they would travel from all these foreign lands to just be around him and sort of just be in his company and be associated with him. And so he's the wealthiest man. He's sort of the king of all the kings in the land. And we also know from the scriptures that he's very, very wise. He's one of the wisest men in all of Israel. But he's wise, he's wealthy, but he's also curious. He's a very curious man. And he wants to know if any of the pleasures under the sun can satisfy the deep longings of his soul. And so he starts with partying. And so look here with me at his party. Chapter 2, verse 1. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what is good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. And you can't see it real very clearly in this passage, but we know from the scriptures, particularly 1 Kings, that Solomon threw some of the most elaborate and some of the most epic parties that Israel had ever seen. 1 Kings 4, if you want to do a little study on your own, goes into detail about some of the parties that he threw. Most scholars would say that his parties had enough food to feed 10 to 15,000 people per night. And he would throw parties that would last for weeks at a time. So these are huge parties. And like, you know, we think we're in New York. We feel like we do some fun things. You know, like we think we go to these great parties. We do some fun things. Like my wife this week, last week she was invited. A very generous church member invited her to this really fancy fashion show in the Village. And so my wife gets up, you know, she gets a new dress, she's ready to go. She goes to the Village for this fashion show, and it's cool, and there are celebrities emceeing the thing, and there are, you know, celebrities doing the music. And my wife, she has a blast, and she gets all the pictures, and it's on Instagram, and she's doing all the cool stuff. But guess what? The party is over, and she came home and still had to change diapers the next day. You know? She still had to cook dinner. She still had to clean the house the next day. Or to maybe put it this way, and you guys have to promise not to judge me, okay? Like I said, don't judge me, okay? This is a safe space, all right? I was in a fraternity in college, okay? And one of the things that we would do as fraternity is all the fraternities on campus would do these week-long parties throughout the year. And so there would usually be these themes. So there was one fraternity that had like a Woodstock theme. So they would transform their house into like it was Woodstock. And they would dress like hippies and all that sort of stuff. Well, my fraternity, we did an island theme. And so we would put bamboo up in the volleyball courts. And we would have, you know, we would wear, you know, swim trunks and stuff and have little parties or whatever. And the way the week-long party would start is early on in the week, we would have just a small sort of private invitation only. Just we would bring our dates, our girlfriends to the party. And we would just get like a local band to come play. And we would have a good time or whatever. And then by Wednesday, it was a little bit more fun. And we would bring like a pretty well-known cover band, like a Michael Jackson cover band called Who's Bad. It was awesome. And they would come in and we would open it up to more people. And it'd be a little bit bigger of a party. And this guy's dressed like Michael Jackson with the one glove and everything. And he's moonwalking across stage singing Michael Jackson songs. And we're having a good time. But by the end of the week, by Friday night, Saturday night, we would be bringing in, you know, as a fraternity, a bunch of college guys, you can't afford to bring in like real well-known singers. So what you have to do is you have to get one-hit wonders from like 15 years ago. I mean, because you got to get somebody with a draw. So we would have, in the years I was in college, we saw Coolio, Gangsta's Paradise, we saw Vanilla Ice, all that sort of stuff. And we would bring in bands like that by Friday. And, you know, it's these old one-hit wonders. And they would, you know, we would invite everybody on campus, and there'd be thousands of people there. And honestly, we would look at one another and we would think, we are having more fun than any 20-year-old could ever possibly have. And we're thinking, we're throwing the biggest, best parties that this college has ever seen. And Solomon is looking at us going, give me a break, guys. You think that's a party? He's like, that's a cute thing that you're trying to do, bringing Coolio in and everything, singing, you know, Gangsta's Paradise or whatever with his heads and with his cornrows and everything. He's going, look, I threw parties that were infinitely bigger than that and infinitely better. I didn't bring in one-hit wonders. I brought in the top bands of the day. We had great food. We had great wine. And we did this night after night after night after night. He said, any party you've ever been to, I've done it better. And he says, I'm here to tell you, they were fun for a little bit, but after a while, they all start to feel the same. And he says, there's really nothing to these things. He says, it was all kind of just vapor in the end. They were fun for a moment, but you wake up the next morning and you feel kind of the same as you did the night before. And so he moves on from parties. He says, that didn't give me any lasting meaning. And so he moves to art. Look in verse 4. He says, I made great works. See, this is a new stage of life for him here. He gets tired of the party scene and he wants to grow up and do grown-up things. So he starts to create art. And the scriptures tell us that he wrote over 1,000 songs. He wrote the Proverbs. I mean, beautiful poetry. I mean, he says he made great works, and he was good at his art. I mean, we still read the Proverbs. We still read the Song of Songs. We read those, and we go, this is beautiful poetry. I mean, he made works of art that we still enjoy today. And some of you are artists, and you think, if I could just capture my emotions, if I could just capture what I'm feeling and put it on a canvas, or if I could just write that song, then that would give me something tangible that I could take with me. And he says, I made great works, and they were fun, but it didn't give my life any lasting meaning. But then he moves on from art. And he builds houses and experiences luxury. He says, I built houses, I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Listen, some of you, myself included, we think that if we could just find that unicorn of an apartment, right? If we could just find that apartment that had either a rooftop or like maybe some backyard space, you know? And we're like, if I could just have that, that would make all the difference. If I could have something green that I call my own, like life would just be better here in the city. And it says here in the scriptures that Solomon's backyard was a forest. And so he's looking at us and he's going, look, trust me, like a 15 square foot backyard is not going to satisfy you. I had a forest. He says, it's not going to change your life that much. So he has the big forest. He decides he wants to build a house and settle down. But Solomon, when he builds a home, he does, and a lot of us think, oh, if I could just own something, or if I could just build a home. Solomon, when he built a house, he didn't just build a little starter home or a little co-op, you know. He builds a massive home. His house that he built actually took him 14 years to build. And if you know anything about sort of Israel at the time, you know that the temple was like the biggest, baddest thing that was made. The temple took 7 years to build. And Solomon's house took twice as long as the temple. So that tells you how elaborate his home was. He made elaborate gardens and parks, and he had pools, and he had all this luxury, and he had great, all the nicest furniture. Listen, whatever your dream home is, Solomon's multiple homes that are infinitely bigger than yours put yours to shame. He says, if you think that a nice apartment is going to give you what you want, give you what you need, give you meaning in your life, he says, let me tell you, it's great, but it doesn't give you any meaning to your life. So he shifts from luxury and power, or luxury and houses, and he moves to power. Verse 7, he says, I bought male and female servants, and I had servants who were born in my house. Listen, he was at the top of the food chain. King of the most powerful nation at the time, hundreds of servants at his beck and call to do what he asked. That's power. They cooked his meals, they cleaned his house, they mowed his lawn, they watered his forest. He was a powerful man with influence unlike anything that you or I could ever imagine. 1 Kings tells us that he had thousands of men that were on horseback at all times, ready to go to war for him at any moment. Think of the power that he has. You think, if I could just get a promotion and have some people working underneath me. And he says power doesn't satisfy, so he moves to materialism. He says, I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than anyone who had been before me in Jerusalem. And here he says, look, I just acquired stuff. I acquired more junk than anyone who had ever lived in Jerusalem before me. You name it, I had it. And you know how excited you get about little trinkets and little toys when they come out? I don't know if you guys are like technology geeks or whatever, or you like to just buy whatever it is you like to collect. He says, look, you think if my collection could just get a certain size, then I would really be able to impress my friends or whatever. He says, look, I acquired more stuff than anyone who had ever lived up to that moment. He said, when something new came out, I got it. He says, but all the new gadgets, the new trinkets, the toys, they were fun for a few days, but I got tired of them pretty quickly. And we've all had the thing where we just had to have it. We got it. And it sort of slipped through our fingertips. It didn't deliver on what it promised. There's an article in The Onion I read a couple years ago. And for those of you who like to share things on Facebook, let me just go ahead and give you guys a heads up. The Onion is satire, okay? Don't share it. Obama didn't say whatever The Onion says he said, okay? Just heads up. But The Onion, a couple years ago when they released a new iPhone, The Onion released an article. And it said, and this is satire, it's comedy. It says, it's talking about Apple releasing a brief moment of fleeting excitement, okay? And it essentially takes a press release from the iPhone and replaces iPhone with fleeting moment of excitement. Listen to this. It says, even before today's announcement, people across the country were lining up to be among the first to get their hands on this new short-lived and non-renewable flash of satisfaction. And they won't be disappointed. This already vanishing glimmer of pleasure is exactly what we've come to expect from Apple. According to one source, rumors are already swirling that Apple engineers are working on a slimmer, briefer moment of excitement projected for release next fall. Isn't it true? You buy the iPhone and the new one comes out immediately. So he tests all the materialism. Now he moves to money. Verse 8, he says, I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women. See, he had more money than you and I could comprehend. 1 Kings tells us that he was richer than any king who had ever lived. He experienced more entertainment than you and I could fathom. We live in New York, and we think it's great that we can go to concerts and sporting events or whatever. And you're like, you save up for months so that you can get a nosebleed ticket to like the Bruce Springsteen concert or whatever that's at the Garden. He's like, forget about buying a nosebleed ticket to the Madison Square Garden. He's like, I just bought Bruce Springsteen and got him to come sing in my palace. He's like, if you want entertainment, I experienced it. And then he moves from money to sex. He says he had many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. The Bible tells us that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. I want you guys to hear this. Solomon experienced uninhibited sexual pleasure. 1,000 women, minimum, at his command. And there is not a fantasy that you can think up in your head that Solomon didn't experience in his bedroom. And this is crucial for us to hear because at this moment in history, our culture tells us that the greatest pathway to our own personal happiness and fulfillment is to experience uninhibited sexuality. That's where our culture is at in the moment. They say that's where you experience the most meaning in your life. And Solomon says, please, don't make this mistake. He says, I've tried it all. He says, you can't place that much meaning on sex because it won't bring the deep and the soul satisfaction that you crave. He says, yes, sex is a good gift from God and it is fun, but do not make it the ultimate thing in your life like our culture has. He said, because it will leave you empty every time. And then he says in verse 9, he says, I became great and I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. And then what he says here is he's like, there's no other way to say it. He's like, I was popular. I had Twitter followers. People wanted to be around me. People knew his name. People stopped him in public to pull out their selfie sticks and take pictures with him. He says, I was popular. I had money. I had women. I had power. I had anything you want. I had it. He said, you want to name a party. I partied in every possible way you could party. But now he shifts and we start to feel a hangover. He starts to tell us about his hangover. See, Solomon pursues all the pleasures that he can comprehend. He acquires anything and everything that he could get his hands on. Now he wakes up, he takes a cold shower, pops a Tylenol, brews a pot of coffee, and after the hangover wears off, he's going to tell us what he found in all of his pursuits. He says in verse 9, he says, my wisdom remained with me the whole time. And here's what he says here. He says, I never forgot what I was doing. Remember that he's a philosopher and he's conducting an experiment. He says, I never, during all of this pleasure seeking, I never forgot that what I was doing was an experiment. He's like, I didn't go Walter White, Breaking Bad, and get lost in the experiment. He's like, I didn't sort of get lost in the craziness of it all. I mean, you almost get the picture that like he would test pleasure and he would take a moment to stop and go write in his journal, go like to think about it and consider like, did this satisfy me? He said, I remembered who I was and what I was trying to do the whole time. I never forgot. And while he was out pursuing his pleasures, he would pause and ponder if any of those things provided satisfaction in his life. Look at what he says in verse 10. He says, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep my eyes from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this alone was the reward for my toil. He reminds us that he did whatever he wanted whenever he wanted to do it. He says that there was no pleasure that was off limits to him. And I want you to hear this because he says it right here in verse 10. He says it was all fun. Like he's not some pastor who gets up and tells you that going out and seeking pleasure is not fun. He says, no, I had a good time. I enjoyed the partying. I enjoyed the sex. I enjoyed the recognition. He says it was fun. I had a good time. But it did not give ultimate meaning to my life. He was like, there has to be something more. Because in verse 11, he says, I considered all that my hands had done and all the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all of it was vanity and striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. And he uses this word vanity again. We talked about this last week. It's the Hebrew word havel, which means smoke or vapor or mist or meaninglessness. He says, I pursued all these things and they were fun for a moment, but it was like mist. Like I tried to grab it and it just like slipped through my fingertips. Like we said last week, it's like a good meal. It's good for a moment, but you wake up the next day hungry. He says, money, sex, power, entertainment. It was good for a moment, but it didn't last. It was like vapor, but the satisfaction disappeared. He says, these things, they made me happy, but they didn't. My happiness didn't stay for long. And last week, Solomon told us, he said, your life is a vapor. You live 70, you live 80 years. And in the grand scheme of things, your life doesn't really make much of a difference. It's here today, it's gone tomorrow, it's vapor. And this week, he says, your pursuit of happiness, that's vapor too. And the reason I showed that video of Tom Brady is because I go, you know what? There's a modern day Solomon. This is a guy who has a net worth of $130 million. He's married to a supermodel. He looks like a supermodel himself. He's the quarterback, which is, you know, the most celebrated position. And he's in the NFL with the Patriots. He wins all these Super Bowls. He's got anything and everything we could ever want. And you see the desperation in his voice when he says, why do I have all these Super Bowl rings? And I still feel like there's something more out there. I don't know if you noticed. He said, I think to myself, God, there's got to be something more than this. Almost like he's praying it. And then the newscaster says, well, what do you think can fix that? He says, I wish I knew. You can hear desperation in his voice. And if, I mean, it gives us insight into what Solomon is saying here. Solomon is like Tom Brady. He experienced everything and he's like, God, there's got to be something more than this. See, we all want happiness. We all want satisfaction, but it seems to elude us when we chase it in the things under the sun. Don Draper from Mad Men. Anybody? There's a scene where he says, this is so profound. He says, what is happiness? Happiness is the moment just before you need more happiness. Reflect on that all week. That's profound. Listen, and can I talk to you as a pastor for a moment? I know that I'm young, and I know that I'm younger than many of you. But everyone in this room, all of you, you all have something in your life that you are convinced that if you just had it, that your life would somehow be more meaningful. And it used to be when you were younger, you used to think, if I could just get into the college I want to get into and get a good degree, if I could just get that thing. And you got in and you enjoyed school, but by the time you were a senior, you had already moved on and you said, if I could just graduate and get a good job. So you graduated and you got a job. And then you said, yeah, but you know what? What I really need, I need to be where the action is. I need to move to the big city. So you came to New York. And then you got here and you said, well, I've got to make it now. I've got to get to the top of my game. So you work and you work and you work 60, 70, 80 hours a week. You find success. You get the promotion. But then you started to panic because you weren't in a relationship. And you think to yourself, I've got to get something more permanent. If I want meaning in my life, I've got to have somebody to share my life with. And so you're like, I want to be married. If only I was married, you tell yourself. But then you get married. And I love marriage. I love my wife. We celebrated 7 years a few months ago. I'm ready for eight, and I'm ready for eight more after that. I love my wife, and I love my marriage. But you tell yourself, if I could just be married, then you get married, and you realize that it's fun, but it doesn't give you all the meaning that you thought it would. And then you start to get the itch for children. If I could just have children, if I could just pass on my name and have somebody to sort of lead and cultivate and shepherd, and if I could just have that, and you think that would be awesome. And so you have kids, but then you get restless again, and kids are awesome, but you still want something more even after the kids. And so you say, you know what? I need to buy a house, or I need nicer furniture, and I need to landscape my yard, or maybe I need to move away from the city and get a place in the suburbs so I can have all these things that I want. So you leave, you get a nice place in the suburbs, and your house will be nice, and you will like your new neighborhood. But you're going to feel bored again because you always do. And you're going to bury yourself once again into your work, and you're going to get more promotions, you're going to stuff your 401k with money, and then you're going to travel the world, you're going to make partner at your firm, and by the time you do that, you're going to go, you know what, it's time for a midlife crisis. And you buy yourself a sports car. And then you go, okay, I got the sports car. And then you go, well, you know what? I've worked. Now it's time to retire. And you retire and you try to, you go move to Florida and you do whatever. And you will do this over and over and over again. You will say, if I could just get this. But by the time you get close to it, you've already picked something else. And you will live your life. You, by the time you attain whatever it is you say you want, you're already looking forward to the next thing. And listen to me, this is me as a pastor. you will always be living for the next thing. And you can live your life convincing yourself that the next thing will fill that restlessness in your soul, that craving that you have for lasting satisfaction, and you will chase the next thing and the next thing, and what you will do is you will distract yourself until you die. You will amuse yourself to death, and you will numb yourself with experiences and things and trinkets and toys. You will shop and you will go in and out of relationships and you'll get promotions and you'll change careers and you'll get new houses and you'll go on vacations and you'll win awards and you'll keep telling yourself that happiness will come with the next thing, but satisfaction will always elude you. Solomon says it's like chasing after the wind. C.S. Lewis said most people, if they really learn to look into their own hearts, they would know that what they want and what they want acutely is something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things that in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never quite keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings that which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. He says, I'm not now speaking of what would ordinarily be called unsuccessful marriages or holidays or learned careers. I'm speaking of the best possible ones. There was something that we grasped at in that first moment of longing which just fades away into reality. He says, I think everyone knows what I mean. He says, the wife may be a good wife and the hotels and the scenery may have been excellent and chemistry may have been a very interesting job, but something has evaded us, the meaning of life. See, Solomon is not saying that any of the pursuits under the sun are bad, because they're not. But what he's saying is that they will not calm the restlessness that you have in your soul for meaning and purpose. See, these pleasures have a purpose in our life, but they are not the purpose of our life. And so that's Solomon's word for us today. And once again, he kind of leaves us a little bit depressed once again. Nothing satisfies. So what's the meaning of life? So what now? What hope is there under the sun? I want to give you guys what I'll call the gospel according to Ecclesiastes, and I'll tell it to you by way of a parable from the New Testament. In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15, Jesus tells a parable of a young man that I think helps us make sense of Ecclesiastes. In the parable, it's called the parable of the prodigal son. Many of you may have heard it. And there's this younger son who sets out on his own sort of experiment, like Solomon. He wants to test pleasure. He wants to test partying. He wants to test what life has under the sun. And so he tells his father, he says, Dad, I want my share of the inheritance. I want my share of the family inheritance. And so his father gives him his money, and the kid goes on his way. And he chases all the pleasure that he can find away from his father's house. He spent all of his money, the scriptures say, he spent all of his money on reckless living. Fill in the blank with whatever you want to fill that in with. He spent all his money, and after all the partying, after all the good times, he ends up broke and hungry. And he ends up actually working for a farmer with pigs, and he ends up in the pigsty with the pigs, wishing he could eat what the pigs were eating. He hits rock bottom, and it occurs to him while he's at rock bottom, he says, you know what, when I was in my father's house, I never lacked for anything. He said, when I was in my father's house, I enjoyed good food, I enjoyed good wine, I enjoyed good parties. But when I tried to enjoy these things apart from my father, they led to despair. And so what he does is he devises a plan to travel back home and hopes that his father would welcome him back in as a slave. And so he travels back home. He's rehearsing his speech. He's like, Dad, I'm going to get to my dad and ask if I can be a slave and just live near the home. But the scriptures tell us that when he was a long way off from his father's house, his father saw him and took off running. His father runs as fast as he can, grabs his younger son, his rebellious son who had run away and squandered all their money, and he gives him a big bear hug, and he welcomes him home. And when he gets him into the house, he starts taking his measurements and gives him a kingly robe, gives him a nice, expensive robe, and he goes out to the pasture, and he kills the best cow on their land, and he went and brought in the best wine, and he throws a massive party and invites everybody in town to come to the party. And he says, come and celebrate, for my son was gone, but now he's back home. And this young man enjoyed in that moment the spoils and the benefits of the most elaborate party he had probably ever experienced. But his greatest enjoyment in that moment was not the party. It was being in the presence of his father. But you can bet that for all the restlessness he experienced away from his father, in that moment where he was in the presence of his father's house, he was able to rest that night. But you also got to believe that he really enjoyed that wine. And he really enjoyed that steak. And he really enjoyed that robe. And what I want you to see is that your desire for pleasure is not a bad thing. But pleasure is not an ultimate thing. See, all the pleasures of this world, sex, money, power, experiences, vacations, they are most enjoyed when they are in the presence of a good father. See, this young man was able to experience those things more fully in the presence of his father's house than he ever was away from his father. See, all the things that Solomon tested, they are most enjoyable when they are enjoyed as gifts from God rather than the destination of our search for meaning. Solomon is going to say that when you seek pleasures under the sun, apart from God's design for those things will never sort of cure your restlessness. They will never deliver. It's like chasing after the wind. And so Solomon says that the good life, it's not found in pleasure. It's found in knowing Jesus and experiencing those things as he gives them to you, not as sort of you try to experience them apart from him. Isaiah 55:1-3 says this. Just listen to the word spoken over you. Jesus says, "Come, everyone who thirsts. Come to the waters, and he who has no money, come and buy and eat. Come buy good wine and buy good milk without money and without price. It'll cost you nothing. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread? And why do you labor for that which doesn't satisfy? Listen diligently to me and eat what is good and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear that your soul may live." Jesus says similar words later when he says, "Everyone who drinks of this water in a well will be thirsty again. But everyone who drinks of the water that I am giving to you will never be thirsty again." Saint Augustine once prayed, "God, you have formed us for yourself. And our hearts are restless until we find our rest in you." And Augustine, if you know anything about church history, you know that Augustine was a party guy himself. And after all of his searching, he says, "You know what? Our hearts are restless, and we try to fill this hole in our heart with all sorts of things, but we will always be restless until we fill that hole with God. And when we fill that hole with God, then all the other things fall into place because they fall into perspective." And so my question for you today is, are you restless? Do you keep searching for satisfaction only for it to elude you? What I want you to hear this morning is that Jesus tells us, "Come to me, all who are weary and all who are burdened, and I will give you rest." You're searching, you're grasping, you're striving, and he says, you feel the burden of trying to fill your life with meaning, and he says, if you want to find it in me. Seek first the kingdom of God. And all these other things that Solomon pursued will then be added unto you. Let's pray. Father, we thank you.